From KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com, it's The Treatment. It's The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest today, well, let's see how we best put this. Let's go over some of the things he's done. Sports Night. He worked with Mike Nichols on Charlie Wilson's War. He wrote Moneyball. He did a little show called West Wing. He adapted To Kill a Mockingbird for Broadway. I would like to bring Aaron Sorkin on to talk about his new film, Trial Chicago 7, but I think we're out of time. Aaron, thanks so much for doing this.
Thank you for the introduction, Elvis. It's very nice to be here.
It's always great to talk to you. And I'd like to ask you about Chicago 7. And then also, when you're doing ensemble work in general, you're writing for a balance of a room and and the way people occupy a room. Often it's two people going toe-to-toe in that room, but also people surrounding that being a kind of de facto Greek chorus audience. Talk about how you worked that out for Chicago 7, given that you're dealing with real people.
As far as the real people go, you mentioned Charlie Wilson's War. That was the first nonfiction that I wrote, and I swore after Charlie Wilson's War, on which I had a terrific experience, but I swore I was never going to write nonfiction again, that the constraints of real people and real facts, you know, who needed it? I'll make up a story. And then I wrote 5 nonfiction films in a row. In fact, I haven't written fiction since. They've just been good stories that I wanted to tell. The ensemble in Chicago 7, you know, you're just, there are a lot of dials and gauges to keep your eye on, but you're always aware of what's the conflict that you're dramatizing right now in this scene. Is it between Tom and Abby? Is it between Bobby and the judge, or Fred Hampton and the guys, Consular and the guys, that kind of thing? And then as far as the Greek chorus goes, yes, you have these other players like Freunds and Weiner, who are kind of the Rosencrantz and Guildenstern of the group. Dellinger, who kind of rolls his eyes at the antics of these other guys, but certainly is as passionate as they are about the cause. I love movies that have a posse, that have a gang, just a group of misfits who have to break into the safe and get the jewels or rescue. I like that in any movie. And, you know, there are 8 members of the Chicago 7, so I had plenty of them in this.
But, I mean, there's somebody who so often who speaks so much common sense that they become, in fact, a kind of comic foil for everybody else.
That's right. Like Hayden, Tom Hayden, played by Eddie Redmayne, the straightest of the group, the most buttoned down. Yes, he is a comic foil for Abby and for Jerry. Abby and Jerry are comic foils for each other. But in Chicago 7, there's no question about it. The crazy guys are running the show. And the button down guys are just trying to get through it.
I mean, because you write drama as if it were screwball comedy, that great thing of American screwball comedy where people are constantly explaining themselves, and the comedy of that, the comedy of narcissism, really, because there seems to be for you a fine line between narcissism and solipsism, and those are usually the bad guys, or the people we look upon as being bad guys, such as the judge in this case. But, I mean, your interest in writing about people who have that kind of self-absorption has always fascinated me.
Well, listen, I take your point, and you're not wrong. You're right. It is self-absorption. I don't call it that. I am not as fast as the characters that I write, as articulate as the characters that I write, not nearly as smart as the characters I write. But that also isn't unusual. Writers write characters that are cooler than they are, you know, can shoot a gun better than they can, drive a car faster than they can, get the women when they can't. That's what writers do.
I think the thing I would say that I see in your character is that is a big part of you is, all this stuff aside, there's this aggressive curiosity that they have and this need to probe. And that's, I think, the thing that makes a lot of these pieces, for me, kind of autobiographical.
Well, let me address the first part first. The probity. Yes, you and I know that drama is conflict. It's intention and obstacle. Somebody wants something, something's standing in their way of getting it. It's the friction of conflict. most often, not always, but most often with what I write, it's a friction of ideas is the problem. And so you're going to get curious characters and characters who will kind of take the time to take a deeper dive than most of us usually would. I don't believe I've ever written autobiographically or ever done it intentionally, at any rate. I don't use the characters as delivery systems for something that I'm trying to say, with a few exceptions. I'll come clean. There have been a few exceptions.
I would disagree with almost all that last sentence. Redirect, Your Honor. But I think that element of really this interest that intersects with passion, that is really at the heart of the work, is who you are as a person.
You may be right about that. Listen, I think it's who my father was as a person, to be sure. And if you knew my father, if you'd had a chance to meet my father, he passed away a few years ago, but if you'd had a chance to meet my father and spend a little time with him, I think that you would say, oh, this is what happened. This man is Bartlett. He is Consular. So I'll give him the credit.
Clearly, I would say the apple doesn't fall far from the tree. And I would guess that a lot of the conversations that took place at the dinner table around your house were these kinds of things, this kind of pushing and ferreting for information, because everything you've written, even To Kill a Mockingbird, at a certain point becomes about the pursuit and sort of exchange of information and turning that into suspense.
First of all, as far as my family dinner table goes, growing up, I'm the youngest in my family. I'm the youngest in a family of lawyers. My mother was a school teacher. Everybody else a lawyer, and then me. At our dinner table, anyone who used one word when they could have used 10 just wasn't trying hard enough, okay? And I loved listening to the sound of their sort of devil's advocate conversations. Well, have you looked at it this way? What about this? And I was rarely ever able to participate in the conversations. I just really liked the sound of them. And so I, you know, becoming a writer, I wanted to imitate that sound. Same thing I'd say with my friends in high school. All of my friend group, they were all just objectively smarter than I was in any way that you can measure smarts, SAT scores, GPA, that kind of thing. And I think I was their mascot. But, you know, Friday nights playing poker with these guys, nickel dime quarter. I loved listening to them talk, too. So a little bit is just phonetic, the sound of being smart.
Well, that's also a part of screwball comedy, too. The sound of people, the sound of being smart, sometimes when people aren't being smart. I mean, we see that early on, the incoming attorney general in Chicago 7.
No doubt about it. Just because they can talk doesn't mean that they're smart, and it certainly doesn't mean that they're virtuous. But listen, you keep invoking screwball comedy, and I'm complimented by that. I love screwball comedies. You know, obviously, I'm someone who's seen The Front Page a million times. And I think that any time you can tell a serious story with a sense of humor, you're doing yourself a favor. You're not asking people to eat their vegetables. And you get to sneak up on the audience a little bit. You can have sort of a screwball run that ends with a kneecapping, an emotional kneecapping.
It's the treatment. The man I'm talking to who clearly is taking the big lead from Ben Hecht is Aaron Sorkin, of course, whose newest project for Netflix is director and writer is Trial of Chicago 7. But I actually bring up Ben Hecht for a reason, because I even think to some extent of Scarface as being a screwball comedy. You know, it's that kind of intent, that push, the kneecapping you just mentioned, and the way Hecht operated as a writer, also too, that division, and I think is a hard balance for a lot of people to strike, writing people who are talking who think they're smart, and people who are smart, who are looking for the exchange of ideas. There's clearly a lot going on here, though.
There is, and Ben Hecht had a whole spectrum there of hyperarticulate characters who were, you know, went from nutty to very brilliant. But, you know, you mentioned Scarface. I was going to move to Scorsese, because if you saw Goodfellas in a theater, there were a lot of laughs in Goodfellas. Laughs at stuff that should repel us. And it wasn't unintentional. Scorsese knew that there was something inherently funny about the way these guys lived, even though they were sociopathic murderers. Clinton does the same thing.
You bring up Tarantino and then Scorsese. I'm bringing up Ben Hecht. A lot of this has to do with velocity, and which is something I mentioned to you before. And as a director, in fact, we can even go back to the opening of pretty much anything you've done to A Few Good Men, certainly the pilot of West Wing, where it's about alacrity and introducing the presumption that the audience is there to pay attention. And you're going to feed that curiosity, because it's when the audience is going to be the freshest they ever are. I think some part of you instinctively recognizes that. So why not grab them when they're sitting down and they're ready to pay attention and give them something to pay attention to and also set the tone?
Yes. What I like to do when I can is drop the audience into the movie while it's going 65 miles an hour and make them sit forward. And if you make the audience a participant in the event, which, by the way, is much easier to do when it's an audience in a theater, when it's a group of people rather than one person watching something on a streamer. Now, let me be clear. I'm incredibly grateful not only that Netflix came along to save Chicago 7, but that everybody came along to save all the films that were coming out this year. But I am clinging to the belief that once it's safe, audiences will go back to theaters, just because we want that experience of being a part of an audience, being a part of a group that laughs at the same time and is silent at the same time, gasps at the same time, cries at the same time. Let me go into the weeds for a second, okay, and talk about the protagonist in Sunday in the Park with George, perhaps Stephen Sondheim's best musical. It is Georges Seurat, the 19th century French pointillist, who painted instead of, you know, using a brush stroke, he painted with the edge of the brush, dot, 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 dot. And in the case of his most famous painting, A Sunday on the Isle of La Grande Jatte, which hangs at the Chicago Institute of Art and also in everybody's dorm room, he used two brushes in his hand, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, red, blue, very, very close together. Because he knew that if the viewer stood back from the painting, which is what he wanted them to do, 10, 15 feet back from the painting, that the human eye would mix that red and blue into a violet more vibrant than he could mix on his palette. So when you're making a film or television show, you want to use the audience the same way. You want them to be involved too. So if you can get them sitting forward and trying to catch up to you, and what's going on here, it will energize the audience. It'll make their experience better. So I do try to do that. I do try to go fast at the start.
We're going to take a break. My guest who wants us all to lean forward and fill in the blanks is Aaron Sorkin. His newest film as writer-director is Trial of Chicago 7. It's The Treatment. There's more to come. Stay with us.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Welcome back. We're talking about breathing and all those kinds of things that Mike Ashman is working. His new film is writer-director is Trial of Chicago 7. But I was talking before the break about suspense and this idea of speed and driving people in. It's that thing that I think sort of really links melodrama and comedy, which is speed, and introducing a lot of things that, given the audience's point of view, can either be tragic or comic. The undercurrent and your work is always that of this tragedy just below the surface as people are speeding through, just because, again, I think your presumption is that in real life, people don't take the time to sort of declare drama in the way they do in movies, and you're looking for a way to fuse those things. At least that's the way it's always felt to me.
That's correct. Listen, what I'm always starting with, before I get to that, before I sort of get to the graduate level writing, which is what you're talking about, I have to do the freshman 101 work, which is just intention and obstacle. Somebody wants something, something standing in their way of getting it, right? If you don't have that, you don't have drama. That's what drama is. So you got to figure that out. And then you can begin to lay in the meal, you know? Because you mentioned melodrama, I wanted to say something else. And it's sort of a speech I've begun giving casts right before we start rehearsal. And it's this. My style of writing, for better or worse, it's I tend to write romantically and idealistically. And in the course of a piece, of a two-hour film or a two-and-a-half-hour play, the writing will start to flirt with melodrama. It'll kind of walk right up to it, walk right up to the edge. And so I am counting on the actors or the director, if I'm not directing it, to, in those moments when it's about to flirt with melodrama, to completely casualize it, to throw it away, or it's going to be opera and it's going to be unbearable.
You're talking about this underpinning of intent, but I think there's also, you have an eye for the way people occupy space in the room. And when you're dealing with as many personalities and points of view as in Chicago 7, you got to be really aware of that kind of balance. And does that become part of the idea of obstacle and intention too, of how you're placing people in the room so that we are aware of points of view being articulated in a way that keep us involved rather than just listening to declamatory stuff?
Yes, absolutely. Look, in the courtroom, it's easy. You know, everybody has their seat. Everybody has their place. Staging those scenes isn't terribly hard. In other scenes, the conspiracy office, in their little holding room that they had at the courthouse, scenes like that, I would stage them being mindful. I would always want the two people who were going to be at each other in this scene, I'd put them on a diagonal, usually, on either end of the room so that everybody else was between them. So that everybody else was still alive in this scene. And you were kind of getting from them the effect of, you called it a Greek chorus. It is that it brings everybody into a scene that's really just about two people in this moment.
Funny, because as you're talking about that, I was thinking about the scene in the park just before the riot breaks out, which is, to me, all about this kind of balance. Because, again, almost everybody is there. Mm-hmm. And but you also got a song being played to sort of offer that idea of real life going on, but also what the song has to offer, that it's also a cover rather than picking a contemporary song from that moment. It's a song that had been performed years earlier. So there's it's playing with the idea of past and present, even in that music, and also the threat of violence. Physical violence, around this emotional violence is happening. All the things you're talking about to me really seem to have risen to the fore in that sequence.
I'm glad to hear that. You know, I was aware going into this that the two riot sequences, what we call the first riot and the real riot, the riot sequences, I would talk about them with the staff as if they were the shark in Jaws. Being aware, I was holding off on showing this until about an hour into the movie before we see this thing that we've been hearing about for a long time. Not always over the past 14 years that I've been working on the film, confident that was the right thing to do. but I stuck to my guns anyway.
But funny, as you're saying that, I'm thinking about the way even the fire is used in the park, almost like the fire is on the beach in Jaws.
Shooting that scene in the park, and those were the scenes that we did first, actually, because we went to Chicago first and shot those scenes in Grant Park on Michigan Avenue, where those things actually took place. And I, as a writer, and my one outing before this as a director, I'm most comfortable with four walls. I'm most comfortable when I'm in a room. because I'm basically a playwright faking my way through movies and television.
What about the scene in Molly's Game where it's Molly and her father on the skating rink?
Right.
I mean, that's outside, and it actually made me think. It reminds me of the scene in the Grant Park in Chicago 7. I mean, were you using music and what that evokes for people versus what's actually happening in the scene? I mean, all these things we're talking about, that sequence to me felt like it was, you're in some weird way, a preparation for the scene in the park.
Perhaps it was. I know I was nervous about that scene. I was certainly nervous about the opening sequence in Molly's Game, the ski crash, but at least the scene in the park that you're talking about, I could turn to Costner and say, am I doing anything right here? There on the set of Chicago 7, there were no Academy Award winning directors.
By the way, we're talking to the director and writer of Molly's Game and Trial of Chicago 7, Aaron Sorkin. It's The Treatment. That opening, too, is a real way of you applying as a director the same kind of thesis you applied as a writer, where you're packing a lot of information in. I mean, I imagine you must have got this, I hate to use this word, forgive me, note from NBC on the West Wing pilot script. This is too much going on. There are too many people, and everybody has a different point of view, and we don't know what it is they're talking about. You must have heard that. I mean, because I know you heard similar things about the opening. Go ahead.
Here are my two favorite notes that I got from NBC early on. Once we were into our second season and the show had established itself as a hit, you get fewer, if any, notes from the network. Early on, this was a show where people were expressing political opinions that not all of NBC's viewers are going to agree with. They didn't know what to make of the West Wing. But here are my two favorite NBC notes on the West Wing. The first had to do with the pilot. One of the things going on in the pilot is that a number of Cuban refugees are making their way on, even to call them rafts would be generous. They're making their way to Florida and they're not going to make it. They're going to drown. And so Josh Bradley Whitford is trying to urge Leo, please, can we send the Coast Guard out there? Can we do something? And I got a note from NBC saying, listen, what if Josh Brad Whitford like got in the boat and went out and saved them himself? Like, that's a much different show you guys are talking about. That's a way different show. My second favorite note that I got in the second episode of the series, we hear about a U.S. Air Force jet. It's carrying some doctors and medical personnel to somewhere in the Middle East. I can't remember. But the Air Force jet has accidentally wandered into Syrian airspace and been shot down. Okay. That episode aired and NBC got a letter from the Arab American Anti-Defamation League saying, you know, we don't like what you did there. That's not nice. And they have a point. Okay, I don't have a problem with the Arab American Anti-Defamation League. However, two episodes later, Richard Schiff, as Toby, had just a throwaway line about Hebrew slaves in Egypt 5,000 years ago. And NBC Legal sent me a note saying, please show your research. So, I didn't know what to do. I sent them Exodus from the Bible. I sent them my family's Haggadah. This is how I learned it. Am I wrong? I wanted to mention, because I know we're running out of time, but I did want to mention something. You and I have talked about this before, how we all felt the film was plenty relevant, Chicago 7, when we were making it last winter. We didn't need it to get more relevant. But obviously in May, with the shooting of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery and others, protests in cities all over America, and in a number of those cities, those protests are once again being met by riot clubs and tear gas and fists. That was eerie enough, looking at CNN's coverage and thinking, you know, if you just degraded the color a little bit, it would look exactly like the footage we use from 1968.
Sure.
You wouldn't think it was going to get the film more relevant than that. And then a week ago Wednesday, Donald Trump went and did exactly what the Chicago 7 were on trial for doing.
Yeah, he got to be everybody but the Black Panther. One of the reasons I want to have you on at this juncture in our history is that I should say we're recording this on the 15th of January, and it will run on Tuesday. It'll be basically the day before inauguration, and it's feeling a lot like Guantanamo Bay right now. I guess I wanted to have you on to have you talk about this a little bit too, because we communicated a little bit last week as all this stuff was unfolding, and with a week's distance, it seems actually more of like an abstraction, but a really dangerous one than it did last week, because it doesn't seem like it's going to go away.
First, let me preface this by saying I don't have any wisdom that other people don't have on this subject, or really any subject. You're right. At the outset, it seemed like a mob just that got out of control and somehow made their way inside the Capitol, didn't really know what they were going to do when they got there. And that was bad enough. Like, they were the dog that finally caught the car. But then with each day that goes by, we find out, no, there were many of them who did know what they were going to do. They were carrying those plastic zip tie handcuffs, that they were going to take people hostage, that they were going to kill some people. You and I both know that if they hadn't been chanting, Trump, 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 if they'd been chanting Allahu Akbar, we would be having a much different conversation about these people. Instead of having the MAGA caps, had BLM hats, we'd be having a much different conversation about these people. So I am glad that it feels like America is taking it as seriously as it should be taken.
To have this movie feel as if it were lifted from the news, even more so now than it did 5 months ago or a year ago as you were shooting it, what does it make you feel about the future of the country now?
No, it is depressing. You feel like that there are episodes in American history that we will never return to because they were awful and we learned from it and sort of made a near escape as a nation and moved forward. I don't know what to do, Elvis, when tens of millions of people believe things that aren't true and refuse to believe things that are. You know, after 9/11, we said, okay, that's it. This world can no longer survive with a whole region of people living in the 9th century and the rest of us living in the 21st. And I say America can no longer survive with this many people living in an alternate reality that simply isn't based in any kind of fact or truth. I don't know what to do about that.
Well, we're not here to solve problems. I just want to get your take on all this, and I think a lot of people would like to hear what you had to say.
So. Okay, because I was hoping you had an answer to that problem.
Well, I'm glad you came here to talk about it. I can't thank you enough for doing this, Aaron. I know how crazy your life is.
My pleasure, Elvis, always. It's always great talking to you, and thank you very much.
Okay, let me thank our guest, Aaron Sorkin, whose new film you can find on Netflix. It's Trial of the Chicago 7, his second film as director and writer. Recording engineer at KCRW is Paul Smith. The show is mixed by Kat Yore. It's edited by Rebecca Mooney. To better days, everyone. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. Catch up on past episodes of The Treatment, go to kcrw.com or listen on your smartphone with KCRW's mobile apps, or subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or if you listen to podcasts. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.